This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is on medical leave. Coming up in the second half of today's show, it is Friday and we have our weekly news discussion with Dave Thompson and Matt Olien reviews Candyman. But we are going to start today with another film. It's called Sadie Breaks the Silence, and silence spelled T-S there. And there will be a screening of this local film at the Fargo Theater on Saturday, September 11th. And joining me now is Janet Brandau. She acted in the film, did costumes, was a producer, art director, even in charge of craft services. Janet, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on today.
And this film is the last film that your late husband, Tom Brandau, worked on. And we should mention Tom, well-loved around this region and particularly at Prairie Public. He was a good friend to Matt Olien, who, like I said, will be coming up later in this show. So just before anything else, how sorry we are to hear about his passing.
Thank you. He was tough and strong, and he fought so very hard. He would be thrilled to know that this project that he had to shelve at a certain point is going to be out for people to see.
And he had to shelf it presumably because of the health concerns, because it was a six-year battle with cancer.
Right. And the kind of cancer he had, you know, you use one kind of medicine until it stops working, and then you try the next one. And so he had a couple of years where he was working on an edit with an alumni, and then it just he didn't have the energy to continue that. So we just put it away and then picked it back up after he passed, and am working with, again, some alums and people he knew to finish it up.
Yeah. I just wonder, and this is sensitive, but working on a film that is both a passion project of yours and your late husband's, there must have been some moments where it got really tough.
Yeah. I mean, people have asked me how I've been for a while because, you know, his illness played out over time. And I would most often say I'm numb because you just have to get through the day to day when you're in a situation like that as a caregiver. And that was nothing compared to what he was going through. And I was surprised, not entirely, but at how much joy there was in picking this up and working on it, because it's a way that we're working together again.
Yeah.
You know, he left us with a really great piece of film, and it didn't need a lot of changing. It just needed finishing touches. Mm-hmm. And so that has been great. And of course, you know, every day I wish he was here to see how it was going and to be doing it himself and all of that. But I think he'd be really proud of what we're doing and glad that it's getting out there so that people can see it.
Did you feel his presence, or even could you kind of hear like what he would be saying?
I am constantly hearing. We have the joke of WWTD, what would Tom do? And so when we're thinking about, you know, how does this look, or what, you know, this take or that take, or anything like that, then it's very much, well, let's think about what he would do. And often that will override our thoughts just because we know we worked with him and knew him well, and he knew his stuff, so why would we doubt that?
Well, the film is called Sadie Breaks the Silence, and silence, S-I-L-E-N-T-S, here. So talk about the play on words of silence.
Yep. Tom usually filmed, his short films usually were semi-autobiographical and set in the 60s and 70s based on things that happened to him in his childhood in Baltimore, and dealt a lot with race relations and social justice issues. And so this film is a real departure. It's set in the silent era. It makes sense in that Tom loved film history. He knew his film history very well. And so this era was intriguing to him. And it also has the social justice aspect of the sexism in the industry already at that time. And so and we had gotten to a point in working together where he wanted to create roles for me. And so this is was going to be the first one of that. It also is ending up to be the last one of that. But, you know, that is what it is. And so it was just a whole different kind of energy. You know, we have a basement storage room full of mid-century props and small furniture and costumes and things. And so we were starting from scratch on this one. But it was fun. I mean, it's a fun period. There's a lot going on socially. And getting to go back into the history of how did they used to do this when, you know, everything is primitive compared to what it is now, but the technology then was developing so quickly, you know, and so how did it all work and how can we show that? And so there's a balance between, there's that serious storyline about how Sadie is being treated, and then there is the somewhat comic storyline about the cast and crew themselves who, you know, nowadays, these are not your A-listers. And so how are they going to figure out to do what they need to do being who they are? And so it's a nice mix, and it's been a lot of fun.
So talking about sexism of this industry and that era, I want to play a clip from the film where the guy who's supposed to direct the film, Rex, turns out to be a total drunk, and so it falls on Sadie to fix everything.
What if I direct it?
Sweet Jesus, you're serious.
She's serious.
Someone's got to do it. Why not me?
Well, for one thing, you've never done it before.
True enough. But I've written every scenario that Pegasus Pictures has put on film for the last 5 years.
Writing one and directing one ain't the same thing. Besides, there's that other thing.
And what would that be?
Who is pre-Sadie? Do I really have to say it?
Please.
You're a woman.
Why, Bert? I'm flattered you even noticed.
Is it your intention to direct this picture?
If that's what I have to do.
Jimmy,
what time's the next train to Los Angeles?
That was a clip from the film Sadie Breaks the Silence. It's going to be a screening at 1 p.m. at the Fargo Theater on Saturday, September 11th. And we are visiting with Janet Brandau, who plays Sadie. That scene, the guy who was going to help just walks away. Mm-hmm. He's like, I'm not going to work with a woman.
Right. And the sad thing is, you know, here we sit 100 years later, and I think a lot of women will say, wait a minute, that still happens. You know, I've been in rooms like that where I was just discounted, and I knew it wasn't because I wasn't a subject matter expert in what we were talking about or whatever. It was just like, I just don't need to pay attention to you because I don't. Hmm. Yeah. So.
Well, I'm curious, what was your late husband's interest in tackling a storyline like sexism? It's obvious to you and me why we'd want this story to be told.
Right.
Why did it interest Tom?
He has always championed women. The film industry at this time was already segregated. Early on, there were women directors. There were troops. There were people of color making films and all of that. And when the studio system got cemented in the 30s, then it became a white male arena in terms of who was in charge and who was the decision maker and who had and controlled the money. And so this is a transitional time. And working in the industry and in education for all the years that he did, saw how few female students there might be at any given time. And so he, if you look at the crew list, for example, he reached out and included as many of his women students as he could. You know, those things have to be intentional for change to happen. People's habits tend to go with, who do I know? And if all you know are people who look like you, then nothing will change. And so he tried in that way, just because social justice issues in general were very much on his mind.
Hmm. Let's talk about just the process of making a film set in the 1920s, because Yeah, the clothing is different, but also the cars are different. The buildings are different.
Right.
The equipment that you're using, and it kind of becomes one of those film within a film sorts of movies. And so there's a lot of shots that show even just the equipment that would have been used in the 1920s. And I'm going to guess you didn't have, you know, a $60 million budget for sure.
If we did, I would have liked to have known about it.
So getting a film like this shot, you've got cars, for example, from the 20s. How did this all come together?
Well, it leads to a funny story from a few years prior to 2015. I am Minnesotan, born and raised, lived here most of my life, and had been to Rolog several times when my children were little and just knew it was a cool place and there was a lot going on there. And so one summer I took Tom there and just said, you need to see this because you're not a Midwesterner. You know, he's a Baltimore boy.
Yeah.
And you're going to be
it's
curious.
It's a real pioneer kind of
right.
town.
And so for me, I'm like, look at all this historic stuff. And this is talking about agricultural history. And he is walking around this whole time going, this would make a great set. You could shoot in that house. It's big enough. Look at that. There's a lake right by the kid. You know, and so he's just doing this
always,
you know,
a filmmaker.
Scoping out, right, scoping out his locations everywhere we went. And so that just kind of was in his mind. So we contacted them and were able to use various buildings and outdoor sites at the Steam Threshers Reunion site for most of the shoot. And then we also already knew about the Comstock House in Moorhead and were able to film in there for the day that we did the producer scenes.
Okay.
And so, you know, that made it a little easier that we weren't building sets and things like that. That's
right.
A time suck.
You had to build that camera, though, right?
We built the camera. We have two friends who are both one is a theater designer and builder, and the other one does a lot of woodworking. And so between the two of them, they looked at the pictures we had, and they put that together, and it just turned out fantastic. And it looks – the one we found was – a German-made camera, you know, Germans and their fight engineering. And on that one, if you open the door on the side, it's all gears. And there's room to stuff a roll of film in there. But it's just all these gears and chains and things. And so just how people thought of these things is amazing.
But I know, right?
It was just very fun. Lots of online searching for things we needed. And then Tom is the one who found all of those historically accurate film props. Because, again, that's He digs that, dug that, and knew what to look for. And then I did a lot of the other parts of the art direction.
How do you classify your working relationship? It's not always easy to work with a spouse.
It isn't, but, you know, this is something that we both love. I think that's what I miss the most about our relationship is that there certainly would be things that we disagree with, but we could talk about anything. And ultimately, we also both knew that in a working setting, someone will ultimately have to make a decision if there's a disagreement. And then it would come down to roles. And there were times when I would say, you know, you are the director and that's your call. I've given my 2 cents worth and that's about what it's worth. And then there were times when he would do the same with me, you know, if it was an area that I was more in charge of and so on. And so that... You know, there's been joy in finishing this project, but there was always joy in working on them, too. I mean, we'd be super tired, sleeping 4 to 6 hours a night the week of the shoot just because, you know, I'd be up sewing that one last costume and he'd be up going over his shot lists and things like that. And, you know, so you see each other through it. And we didn't have a huge problem with that. Mm. So...
I want to play another clip from the film, and this is where Sadie has fully stepped into being the director, but still she has got to take some flack from the actors in the film, and she gives it right back.
I had another idea. What if Caroline initiates the encounter?
Ooh, I like that.
Well, I certainly do not. The notion is absurd.
Why is it absurd?
Yeah, why?
Yeah, why?
Look here, I am a rough and tumble cowboy. I ride the open plains. I punch cattle and bust broncos and beat up desperados and seduce young prairie widows.
You spend most of your time on long cattle drives with a bunch of other cowboys. The only real woman you have any contact with is your mother, And the most meaningful relationship you have is with your horse. So tell me, cowboy, what do you know about wooing a woman?
Janet, how much are you like Sadie?
Sadie stays calmer than I do.
I can have a little temper,
but, you know, she has to wrangle all of these cats and get them all moving at least sort of in one direction for the day. Being in that place and just saying, what is wrong with all of these people right now? Come on. You know, we've all been there. Similarities, but I think she tends toward the calmer than I do in a situation. Because, come on, now,
yeah.
Period, you know.
We've mentioned that there is a film within
yes.
this film. She's obviously directing the picture that's in this movie, and then you play parts of that over the closing credits. Mm-hmm. Can we see that film at all?
What you see in the credits is what we shot.
Okay.
It's funny. That was shot on film with a camera called a Bolex, and so the rest of the film was digital, as things are now.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, you talked about the budget being on the what's known in the industry as a micro budget. It's not that we couldn't have gone out and bought lots more rolls of film, but that's got to come out of something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so the last shot in the silent film in the credits is the point at which the film ran out. We kind of shot them in order, and Tom was just calculating as we went because he knew how many minutes of film were on the rolls he had. It was wonderful. So I think at the most we ever did two takes on film, and on the last one that people see, they did the take, and then the camera stopped because it's a wind-up camera. It was amazing. And we all just looked at each other and went, I think we're done.
And that's a wrap. That's some serendipity there. We are speaking today with Janet Brandau. She acted in the film Sadie Breaks the Silence. She also did the costumes, was a producer, art director, and even made sure the rest of the cast and crew got fed. You can watch the film Sadie Breaks the Silence at 1 o'clock at the Fargo Theater on September 11th. It is the last film that her late husband, a longtime filmmaker and MSUM professor, Tom Brandau, ever worked on. Janet, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Still to come on Main Street, a Plains Folk essay from Tom Ezern.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by MITCO, investing in hometowns to bring an expanded fiber network and next-gen tech to your door. Fiber is the future, and at MITCO, the future is already underway. MITCO.com/fiberforward.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Tom Ezern is an historian and storyteller. And today, in this week's Plains Folk essay, he goes off in search of someone who seems to be equal parts myth and man. It's called Man by the Name of Crego.
It was in 1941 that America's great Shakespearean scholar, George Lyman Kitty Kittredge, slipped the surly bonds of Cambridge, Massachusetts, never more to enthrall and terrify the boys of Harvard. Kitty would not have been at home on the range, but he was a mentor to the greatest of all collectors of Western ballads, John A. Lomax of Texas. The eminent Harvard scholar was himself a student, too, of the ballad tradition. Kitty Kittredge pronounced the Buffalo Skinners, or as I prefer to call it, the Range of the Buffalo, the greatest of all American ballads. The admiring Lomax, in turn, dedicated his published text of the ballad in honor of Miss Dora Kittredge, a cryptic dedication that leaves it uncertain whether the admiration was for Kitty or for daughter Dora, a mystery on which I occasionally muse. Before I slide off into soap opera, however, let me get back to the serious business of folkloristic scholarship. The origins of the range of the buffalo are complex and obscure. The song tells the story of a naive buffalo skinner who signs on with a man by the name of Crego, a hard and unscrupulous buffalo hunter on the plains of West Texas, operating out of Jacksboro in 1873. Within a few years, the Center for Buffalo Hunter Outfitting would shift north to Dodge City, Kansas, and eventually to Dickinson, Dakota Territory. Crego takes the gang into desolate country across the Peace River, treats the men badly, and, worst of all, tries to skin his way out of paying them their just wages. Consequently, the narrator says, they left his damned old bones to bleach on the range of the buffalo. In his autobiography, Lomax recounts his meeting with an old-time buffalo hunter in Abilene, Texas, who claimed to have been on the ill-fated expedition with Crego, and who said he and his comrades not only perpetrated the murder, but also composed the ballad. This story of origin is dubious. At any rate, the song circulated wildly. Lomax culled his compiled verses from scores of singing informants. Young songcatcher Franz Rickaby of the University of North Dakota found the song in the Flickertale State. I have located the version he collected in his notebook at the University of Wisconsin. Most ballad scholars trace the genealogy of the buffalo skinners back to lumberjack ballads of the North Woods, such as Canada-io and Michigan-io. It was in 1991 that I discovered the connection back to a seaman's ballad, The Voyage of the Buffalo, set down in the journal of Second Master T.F. Cheeseman of the HMS Buffalo during a visit to New Zealand in 1836. I stumbled onto his original journal in the Turnbull Library of Wellington. Oddly, given the memorable villainy of this man by the name of Crego, it seems odd no one has attempted to determine whether there was such a man hunting buffalo on the plains in 1873. In fact, I learn there was. A fellow named Crego was among the original builders of Adobe Walls, the famous buffalo hunting outpost in the Texas Panhandle. I believe this Crego was the same chap who was encountered by Missourian Robert M. P. Cooper on the Buffalo Range in 1877. Companions warned Cooper not to sign on with this Joseph Crego, saying he was wanted for crimes back in the States. But Cooper did go west with Crego, although he found him eccentric. By his account, published in Missouri newspapers in 1899, Cooper saved Crego from a stampede. Nobody killed Crego, and when he died in 1899, he named Cooper the beneficiary of his estate. It may be true, as the song says, that God's forsaken the buffalo range and the damned old buffalo. But the ballad remains to confirm Kitty Kittredge's blessing upon it.
Dr. Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, Matt Olean reviews Candyman, and Dave Thompson is here for our weekly news chat. But now it's time for today's news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Disappointing and needlessly reckless. That's how North Dakota Public Service Commissioner Randy Chrisman reacted to news that Otter Tail Power Company wants to relinquish its stake at the Coyote Station power plant near Beulah by 2028. Otter Tail has a 35% stake in that 420-megawatt plant. In its integrated resource plan filed with regulators in the Dakotas and Minnesota, Otter Tail proposes to make its natural gas-fired Astoria Station in South Dakota a dual-fuel plant and to build a new 150-megawatt solar power facility in a location to be named later. Chrisman says Otter Tail has been a wonderful manager of the Coyote plant, and because of that, Otter Tail has had reasonable rates.
But that being said, the thought of walking away from it now to rely on a new solar farm and a peaking plant filled with natural gas. Those are volatilely priced commodities. And, of course, we know that on a cold winter night, the solar, at least it is predictable, it's going to produce nothing.
Chrisman says he's also concerned that increased reliance on natural gas to produce electricity will mean higher prices for North Dakotans who use the gas to heat their homes. He says he's already raised these concerns with Otter Tail officials. The PSC has been given more oversight authority concerned integrated concerned resource plans. Chrisman says the PSC can open a case and do more investigation. He says those plans are usually quite detailed. The state health department has confirmed the deaths of two more North Dakotans with COVID-19. The statewide death toll is now 1,564. Additionally, another 445 individuals from 39 counties have also tested positive. According to the health department's coronavirus dashboard, today's results are from a batch of 8,417 tests for a daily positive rate of 5.53%. There are currently 2,908 active confirmed cases in the state. 105 people are currently hospitalized due to COVID-19, and since yesterday, 238 people have recovered. And a panel of Minnesota state lawmakers and commissioners face a Monday deadline to agree on how to distribute $250 million to pandemic frontline workers. Members of the working group held their last scheduled meeting, but they could not agree on how many workers would be eligible for that pay, nor could they agree on how much each individual would receive. DFL members are pushing for a broad list of eligible workers, but GOP Senator Karen Housley says there are limitations.
I think we have to be honest with the public and be real with what we're working with, because again, it is, we have $250 million. That's it.
By law, the working group must make its recommendation by September 6th. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
The other day when we were driving along the road, we noticed a car with a flat tire, and I said, oh yeah, that one's flat as a flivver. My husband said, yep. And then he said, what is a flivver? I don't know. That's something I've said for years and years and years.
A piglet walks into a bus station and says, I want a ticket. And the clerk says, where to? And the piglet says, none of your damn business.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
When you hear that old teletype machine, you know it's time to check in with our veteran news hound, news director Dave Thompson. 40 years and 2 days at Prairie Public.
40 years and counting, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And we would like to say thank you to all our listeners who became members or increased their donations during that one-day drive that we did in honor of 40 years on the air. So I bet many thanks.
I bet we gave a lot of socks.
Yeah.
But I was kind of looking at that coffee mug, and I only have 16 coffee mugs from Prairie Public.
Only 16?
So I
out of 40, what do you get, one every leap year?
Well, pretty much.
You should have, at least 40 coffee
mugs. I would think,
mugs.
Yes.
Well, congratulations to you, Dave, on 40 years. That's
thank you, Ashley.
Remarkable achievement.
And I'm just getting started.
Okay, yeah. We do have a couple of health-related stories this week, some of which are totally pandemic, one of which is pandemic-related. Mm-hmm. Drug overdose deaths claimed 118 lives in the state in 2020. That's up from 79 in 2019. It sounds like they do think that the pandemic had a big impact on this.
Right. As people were isolating during the pandemic, they weren't seeing a lot of friends. Some people would get into opioid situations, they would overdose, and there would be nobody around to make the 911 call or to give somebody naloxone to help them recover. So they saw a spike in that, and they believe that's part of it. So the health department and the human services department are encouraging people to, you know, keep in contact with your friends and your relatives and, you know, watch them very carefully, you know. Make sure that they're all right and they're not overdosing on anything.
Right. Well, drug use can already be a major ordeal, and then you throw in a difficult time, and that is going to increase anxiety and depression for some people. And then, like you mentioned, if you're doing drugs alone, there is nobody to call in if you are overdosing. I'm wondering about this access to naloxone, which is something that can reverse overdose impacts from opioids anyway. It's available from certain local public health units and pharmacies. You can even get some through the state, the Division of Behavioral Services. Have you spoken with anybody there? Are there increased attempts to get this death prevention, overdose prevention drug in people's hands?
Yes, and I have heard from a number of health professionals that they see an increase in the request for naloxone. So, you know, some of this is starting to hit home a little bit. And you know, it's one of the unintended consequences of what has happened with the lockdowns, with the social distancing that happened during the pandemic.
Yeah, people are social. In the meantime, Governor Doug Burgum has been meeting with health officials from hospitals across the state, checking in with what's happening there as the Delta variant continues to surge in these parts. And also, it sounded like he was almost near tears asking people to get vaccinated.
Right. And he's very much aware of the situation, and he wants to get people the vaccine that will help them avoid the worst of COVID, and especially with the Delta variant going around. And, of course, we're now seeing more young people because the Delta variant, A, is starting to target the younger crowd now. So we're seeing people in their teens, early 20s who are getting it.
As school is back in session.
And there's really a lot of concern. Now, flip that over with the concern that's rising that some people have that say, you know, you should not infringe on our rights by imposing mask mandates. So there's been a number of protests around, and there have been protests on college campuses because NDSU and UND had been talking about masks. UND, I believe, is still making them voluntary, whereas NDSU is talking about mandatory if you're indoors. And there were a couple of big protests at NDSU very recently about that, hoping that the president will reverse this position. So there's a lot of churn. That's the way I'm going to put it. There's a lot of churn on this whole thing in terms of, you know, what's the best efforts? What do I need to do to protect myself and protect others?
I saw that Danielle Webster posted a story, 463 new cases confirmed this week.
Yes. And that's been a rise in case numbers since really early summer. They were down into the teens each week. And now we're getting more and more about this. And again, the concern about the variants as they spread. Now, I have been told that there is another one called the Lambda variant. Don't know much about it. I just know that somebody mentioned it. It hasn't been found in the United States just yet, but that may be another variant. And, you know, viruses act that way. They always find some ways to mutate, to spread, and to look for other hosts.
Yeah, they are successful at that.
Yes.
The North Dakota Department of Public Instruction updating library media standards. They haven't done this in nearly a decade.
In years, exactly. And with the new social media platforms, as a matter of fact, when I interviewed Kirsten Basler, the superintendent of public instruction, she said TikTok is almost ancient history.
I know, right?
Now, I never got into TikTok, so I don't know how to get into it. But, you know, there are new platforms coming out all the time. And, of course, there's a spread of information, but there's also the spread of disinformation. And her point was that we need to have standards to help, you know, students discern what is true news and what is fake news. And I'll tell you what.
We need that for some adults, too.
Exactly. I've looked at some Facebook feeds, and I'm Truth be told, I'm on Facebook for a couple of reasons. Number one, to stay in touch with friends and family. And number two, to get news tips. And if I can get on my soapbox again, never, ever. I'll tell young journalists there, never, ever take a tweet and report it unless you have made the call to verify it. And that's one thing that drives me right up a wall. Oh, we can put this on the air. It's a tweet. No. There are a lot of bots out there, a lot of people spreading a lot of fake information. Until you find out it's the truth, you know, make the calls, do your legwork. That's that type of thing.
Right. Well, that's for journalists, but also for people who are media consumers.
Right.
Read verified news sources.
Right.
Not just things that tell you what you want to hear.
And that's why Prairie Public has a Facebook presence and some Twitter presence. I have this hope that real, legitimate news sources are going to win out in the end. I hope. And it's going to take some work. It won't happen overnight, but I'm still thinking that as people get wise to some of the tricks that people play about faking information, maybe they will come back to the more legit sources.
Another part of this media standards update is the cybersecurity. And did I read this correctly? They want to be teaching all the way to kindergartners about cybersecurity.
And a lot of these people who are in the library business are also some of the people who are teaching cybersecurity. And they really want to get cybersecurity literacy into the kindergarten kids, because if you start talking to them and teaching them about cybersecurity, they will be more savvy as they go along.
Right. Well, honestly, I think some of those kindergartners could be teaching these classes
Pretty much, anyway. Yes, exactly.
Another school-related story in West Fargo, the public school system, they're terminating the transportation operations supervisor. He says this is in retaliation for fighting for wages. They say it's because of some testing that he hadn't yet completed.
Oh, yeah. The thing about that, there was a meeting a few weeks ago. The West Fargo bus drivers met with some members of the administration to argue for higher wages. West Fargo bus drivers say of the people in the Fargo-Moorhead metro area, they're probably the lowest paid. And it's something like $15 or $15.50 a mile or something like that, or an hour. And they're not the only ones who are seeing a shortage of bus drivers. That's become, I think, a real issue across the state. And pay might be a problem, but just the lack of people who really want to do this could be a real problem. But in West Fargo, it has turned into kind of an ugly public fight.
Do most bus drivers tend to be unionized? Do you know?
I don't think so. I think it's loose associations.
Okay.
Maybe some of them are unionized, but the ones I have talked to, you know, it's loose associations. They try to band together and say, we can do it as a unit to bargain.
The Public Service Commission approving a transfer of permits for water and high voltage power line. What's going on here?
Okay, this is
conjunction. This is two different things, right?
Right. Okay. But it's conjunction with Coal Creek Station Power Plant, which is being sold from Great River Energy to Rainbow Energy of Bismarck. So there's this huge power line. It's 400 plus miles of this high voltage direct current line, so that means a lot less line loss.
Okay.
And this is a real selling point when it comes to that power plant, because they can serve customers in Minnesota pretty reliably. So that's part of the deal. Also, you've got to have water to, you know, produce the steam that produces the steam from the coal. You need water, so you've got the water permits. And I find it extremely interesting that these were some of the first permits that the Public Service Commission issued, because before that didn't have jurisdiction. It became the 75 session that gave them some jurisdiction.
Wow.
And these date back to 1976.
Wow. I had no idea. Gasoline prices in North Dakota fell recently, but it looks like because of Ida, they might be going back up. But also because of Ida, there may be some benefit to the state.
Right. It's interesting that, you know, first I talked with Patrick DeHaan, who is with GasBuddy.com, and he said, yeah, we think maybe 5 to 15 cents based on the hurricane.
Okay. And this is because refineries in Louisiana
are
in
shut
that
down.
Area, they're down. Okay.
And also they cannot ship in foreign oil. So that's another interesting story. And that's why it could impact the Bakken, because there seems to be more demand to find some crude oil, because if the refineries get back up and going, they may be able to refine the crude, but maybe they can't get the cargo ships in. So they think that that's going to help out the Bakken a little bit. It probably will add a couple hundred thousand barrels a day to the refining capacity down in the Gulf area. And, of course, you've got the Dakota Access Pipeline, which runs to Illinois, and then there's another pipeline that runs from Illinois to Louisiana and Texas. So they can take care of Bakken crude that way.
Do we still have the bodies out in the oil patch? Because, as you know, there was a bit of a slump and
right.
a lot of people packed up and moved, even some companies.
I think you've raised the million-dollar question right there because we see now that there are more frac crews. They were down to about 5 frac crews. Now we're starting to see it get back close to normal, but help wanted signs are out there to get these drilled wells fracked and completed. And that's a really big job.
All right. We check in with News Director Dave Thompson once a week. Thanks, Dave.
Hey, thank you, Ashley.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas, Director of Radio at Prairie Public, and today, Director of Thankfulness. Wednesday was the 40th anniversary of the first radio broadcast by Prairie Public, and it was one of our best fundraising days ever, matching the $10,000 grant from Jeff and Mindy Glickman. It is my glad duty to thank all of you who contributed. If you missed your chance, you can always go to prairiepublic.org. Thanks again to our Wednesday donors. What a great anniversary.
Next on Being, banjo icons Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn, partners in music and in life.
The dreary regions of the...
I'm Krista Tippett. Join us.
That's On Being, Sunday night at 9 Central.
When you hear the fanfare, you know it is time for another film review with our movie critic, Matt Olien. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Sure.
You have been to see a horror film, The Candyman, or Candyman.
Just Candyman, yeah. Did very well opening weekend, $22 million at the box office. Maybe people are ready for some horror, for some frights. Nia DaCosta is the director. Jordan Peele producing, and he can't miss these days, whether he's directing or producing horror movies. Get Out, Us, now Candyman. So there was an original Candyman movie long mm-hmm. time ago, which I didn't see.
Yeah.
So I really had no jumping off point here. But essentially, the plot follows Anthony McCoy. He is a artist in Chicago, played very well by Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. And he lives with his girlfriend, played by Tiana Paris, and she's an art dealer. So she sort of curates his work and their boyfriend and girlfriend, and he's not quite sure what his next exhibit should be. Well, through some flashbacks and running into a very strange person, he hears about the Candyman legend, this supposed man who gives candy to kids, but he's evil and he kills and he comes back from the grave.
Razor blades in the candy,
yes,
right?
Exactly. So this is an old case the Chicago cops were investigating. But if you've seen the trailer, Ashley, you know that the summoning involves someone looking in a mirror and saying Candyman 5 times.
Oh, I remember this as a kid. I was too scared to do it.
So, of course, we're in a movie and you know someone's going to do it. Someone's going to look in that mirror and get things going and all heck is going to break loose from there. So it's a short film, about 95 minutes. Like this a lot. Didn't like it as much as Get Out and Us in terms of the Jordan Peele horror trilogy that we're underway right now. But Yahya Abdul-Mateen is really the star of the movie as he wrestles with the exhibit he's doing. He's fascinated by the Candyman legend. Is he going to work that into his new art exhibit? Is all heck going to be unleashed? A lot of interesting scenes. I like how some of the violence is handled. Sometimes we see the violence and sometimes we don't. It kind of happens off screen or you can hear it a la Cat People, which was a old film made in the 40s where you kind of saw the cats in shadows, like the panthers ripping up people's limbs, but you never quite saw it. So it's all kind of done by Nia DaCosta in sort of, ooh, we're hearing what's going on, but we're not seeing it all the time. And I like that effect a lot. She does it sometimes with the violence, and sometimes it's more direct, like we're, you know, you're getting the blood and gore that horror fans like to see. But I also like a specific scene at a high school where everything is off camera and you're only hearing the bludgeoning going on. So I like that part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's such an important part of, I guess, probably any director, but I feel like especially in suspenseful and horror and thriller kind of films, is the ability to know when to use the audience's own imagination against them.
Mm-hmm. It's a judgment call.
Yeah.
Directors make choices all the time. They make choices when they get different angles in a scene, and then they make choices in the edit booth, which, you know, a lot of films can be ruined or saved in the edit booth. So I like how she kind of mixed and matched. I did find her direction a little numb sometimes. Like I was kind of – I wanted to be shifted into fifth gear, and sometimes I felt we were in 3.5 or fourth gear as a horror film, so maybe not quite a masterpiece, quite a classic. Some of the plots a little hard to follow. I like how in some of the flashbacks we see like animated puppetry, like, oh, this Candyman in the 1920s was chased down by Chicago police, black man. And this is being told by a black man that Anthony McCoy encounters, who kind of knows the legend. And so I like how they're doing kind of flashbacks through puppetry and animation. But some of the plot holes were a little tough to follow. Like all of a sudden characters show up and you're like, oh, is this a flashback? Hmm. Is this not a flashback? That was a little confusing in parts. But overall, I liked it. Not as good as Get Out and Us, but still a very effective horror movie that I think people like. Also, there's some messaging here, too, about gentrification of neighborhoods in Chicago, race issues in Chicago. Mm. Those kind of come up as our main character kind of plods his way through this film. These kind of interesting social issues pop up as well as kind of like a side plot.
How does this film compare with the director's other work? She hasn't been around a long time,
no,
right?
No, she doesn't have a huge body of work. She did a film called Little Woods a few years ago that I liked, but this is probably her breakout, I'm guessing. This looks to be, you know, through Jordan Peele's producing, giving a up-and-coming black female director a big opportunity to direct a horror film that's going to make money. So this is probably her jumping-off point from smaller independent films.
That's a pretty big jumping off point.
It is.
And
it is.
To debut and make $22 million in the first weekend, good for her.
It definitely is.
All right. Well, for the Oscar trivia, I want to talk about other horror films that have been – there have only been a very few that have been nominated for Best Picture and only one that went on to win it. So I'll give you the year. You give me the film. 1973.
The Exorcist.
1975.
Jaws.
1991.
Silence of the Lambs, which won?
Which won, yes. 1996.
Ashley, 1996, horror movie.
I mean, it's possible you could more accurately call it a suspense film, the guy who sees dead people.
Oh, The Sixth Sense.
2010?
2010. Ooh. Kind of gapping on that year. I'm going to give up
it's
on that one.
That's when Natalie Portman gets her.
Oh, Black Swan. Black
and
Swan.
And 2017.
That was
this
Get
one.
Out, yes.
All right. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Summer is almost over, but that doesn't mean it's too late to talk about our favorite summer songs, like this one you're hearing right now.
It just reminds me of being a kid, and you're off from school, you're at the public pool, you're hanging out, you paid your 15 cents, you get your free sandwich, and you just feel like everything's going to be all right.
Songs of the Summer. Next time on It's Been a Minute. From NPR.
Saturday at 2 Central, 1 Mountain.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 3rd. In late August 1911,
A horrible fire in Topeka, Kansas, did more than $100,000 damage in the business district. The reports noted that the J.C. Gresser Furniture Company and the Grebs Clothing Company were hit the hardest, but what caught readers' attention in North Dakota was the news that a photo studio also burned, killing a man named Evans who lived in the studio. The news spread quickly around North Dakota, and for good reason. Many thought it was Oliver Evans, a photographer from Devil's Lake who had planned on moving. Oliver Evans was popular in Devil's Lake and well-known around much of the state. In 1905, 6 years before the Topeka fire, the Fargo Forum called him the leading photographer of Devil's Lake. The comment appeared in a story about Evans and a partner purchasing Freeman's Photography Gallery in Fargo. The partner would focus on the Fargo establishment, while Evans would devote time to the Devil's Lake Gallery. The name of the business was changed to Drysdale and Evans. In 1906, Evans took a Devil's Lake newspaper editor on an automobile tour, showcasing his automobile skills. Though the day was beautiful, there were no photographs taken to commemorate the event. In the afternoon paper, the editor reported, "Friend Evans did not take his camera, for," said he, "with my wife and an editor along, I shall have enough to perplex me without doing any field work." Later that year, multiple newspapers reported an interesting tidbit that Evans owned a book that was over 200 years old. Published in 1641, it was titled Moses, His Choice, by Jeremiah Burroughs. As it turned out, Oliver Evans was a victim of misidentification, for he had not yet left Devil's Lake, nor did he have family living in Topeka. In fact, on this date, he was still arranging to sell his gallery. After receiving many calls about the Topeka fire from papers around the state, the Devil's Lake Weekly World checked on Evans, who asked that his friends be notified that he was a lively corpse. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Paula Poundstone talked about why she will not be taking over as host of Jeopardy.
I was on a celebrity episode where we played for a charity, and let me just say, my charity had to pay money to Jeopardy.
I'm Peter Sagal. Why not enjoy a quiz show where embarrassing ourselves is built into the brand? Join us for this week's news quiz with special guest Martin Short from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, it is Labor Day, so we're airing a discussion about work, hard work. Our director of radio, Bill Thomas, visits with Michael Patrick F. Smith, author of The Good Hand. It's about his time working in the Bakken. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy your holiday weekend.